Welcome back to the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. Sentientism answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I talk to John Oberg. John is a professional animal advocate and public speaker. You can find him on Twitter, Facebook, Patreon, and at johnoberg.org. I'd love to know what you think of the podcast, so why not write a review or give us some stars on your podcast platform. You can find out more about sentientism at sentientism.info or search for the word sentientism on any social media platform. You'll be made welcome in any of our global community groups. They're open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. Hey, John, how are you?
Hey, Jamie, great to be here.
Yeah, thank you for making the time to join this sentientist conversation. So it's a pleasure to see you off Twitter and almost in real life.
Almost in real life, yes.
Almost, it's the closest
we'll
get.
Excited to be here and to chat with you across the ocean.
Yeah, cool. So as we've talked about before, the idea behind these conversations is to try and understand how people answer two of the deepest questions in philosophy. So the first is what's real, and the second one is what matters. And I guess my interest in launching these conversations, and the reason they're called sentientist conversations, is because it's part of this amateurish project to popularize and build community around a really simple philosophy called sentientism, which says when it comes to what's real, we should use evidence and reason and take a naturalistic approach to forming our beliefs. And when it comes to what matters, the clue's in the name, we should grant moral consideration to anything that is, or any being that is capable of experiencing things, capable of suffering or flourishing or sentient. So it doesn't say anything more than that. It's a super simple philosophical baseline, if you like. But having said that, I'm talking to people who disagree with both of those elements or neither, or agree with both or neither. So we'll see how the conversation goes. But yeah, thank you very much for joining the conversation and talking us through your philosophy and its implications for the future.
Absolutely, Jamie. I'm happy to be here. And I don't think that we'll be bashing heads too much.
We'll see.
They're probably on fairly similar wavelengths, but we'll see. Excited to dive in with you.
Sounds good. And before we kick off, it would be great if you, for people who don't know your work already, if you could just give an introduction to your life, your work, your focus, and what you concentrate on.
Absolutely. So my name is John Oberg. I live in Virginia in the United States. It's on the East Coast. I've been a vegan activist for just over 11 years. I went vegan in 2009, got involved with activism right away. It's now early 2021. And I grew up an animal lover and an animal activist, an animal advocate, but it wasn't until my early 20s that I learned how farm animals are being treated, and went vegetarian and eventually vegan, got involved with activism. And it's been certainly the best change of my life. And the advocacy that I've participated in over the years has really given my life a lot of meaning. And I've really felt like I've made a big difference for animals, and I continue to, and that means the world to me. And I get a lot of enjoyment, not just getting others to go vegan, but also helping other advocates to be more effective. My particular focus is through social media advocacy. I've found that utilizing the social media platforms at our hands, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, particularly for me, are the platforms where I can really exponentially reach more and more people. And in the last several years, my posts have been seen tens of millions of times across these platforms by the eyes of individuals around the globe. And certainly, I have great reason to believe that leads to people making kinder choices for animals. And I'm no magician. I don't have a PhD in social media science. I'm just a regular human being who looked at what works in social media and what doesn't. And I decided to make an effort to really focus my energy on social media. And so that is where I focus my efforts. And that is how we met. And so I'm excited to chat with you more about my advocacy through social media, but also just my philosophy in general about how we can help animals.
Sounds great. And it's an amazing reach. And it's interesting how you've both played the advocacy role working as part of other organizations, at, you know, the advocacy you do as an individual, but also the work you do trying to help other advocates be more effective as well. Yeah, it's great to hear. And we'll come back to those themes at the end of the conversation about how we can make the world a better place, really. So before we come on to those themes, it would be good to start by rolling the clock back as we answer that first question, what's real? And for many people, that's a story about whether they grew up in a household and a society that was already naturalistic or atheistic, whether it was religious or supernaturally based, and how and whether that worldview, that perspective on what's real, has shifted over their lives until the present day. So it'd be interesting to know your personal story on that side of the philosophy.
Absolutely. It's cool to dive into this. I don't usually talk about religion or lack of religion.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to cover that topic with you, Jamie. So I grew up in a pretty non-religious setting. The United States is a fairly religious place. I grew up in the Midwest, where it's a pretty religious part of the country. But I never had organized religion thrust upon me or anything.
Yeah.
I think the, you know, concept of God was always floating around, and it was generally agreed upon that I guess God exists, but it was very rarely talked about. I grew up with just basically with just my mom, and we really didn't explore that idea much. And it was not until years later where we got more clarification with each other. But I do remember when I was so I grew up in pretty much a non-religious place, but I guess I believe that God existed. And I actually recall when I was 14 years old, I was sitting in ninth grade math class. And I remember just sitting there and I thought, you know what? God doesn't exist. This doesn't make any sense. And I remember I was like, I'm an atheist. And I realized I'm sure a lot of that had to do with trying to find my identity as a teenager. But I definitely, that was like the moment I realized religion doesn't really make sense. And so that was, so I was like this adamant atheist for a number of years, powerfully rejecting Christmas and things like that. And then I realized like, I gotta stop being such a sourpuss. This is really turning people off. So I stopped being so loud about it. My atheism ensued. And as time went on, my mom and I would talk about it more and more. And I think that she was pretty much on the same page as me. And as time went on, I got less strict with my atheism and more like, I would say more agnostic, in the sense that I believe that there's probably no God, but just as I can't be certain of anything, I can't be certain that is not the case. So, and something that really led me to start going in that direction as well was that my mom got sick, and she was diagnosed with stage 4 small cell lung cancer about 7 years ago, actually 8 years ago. And then she died 5 years ago. And so I took care of her in her final years. And I really struggled with the concept that I'd never be able to see her again.
Yeah.
And so
that's hard.
Yeah. And so I decided, you know what? I think I'll just be agnostic. I believe that there's probably no God. I'm not completely ruling it out. And I do the concept of being able to see my mom again one day does bring me comfort and help me be able to move on with her passing. So that's where I am in life and you know, where I am today.
Yeah. It's similar with me. And I think you're right. There's often that turning point in the teenage years where you start to think things through for yourself and reevaluate some of the background assumptions. But I had a similar experience to you. I think for some people who are in a really strongly religious environment, sometimes it's actually ethical problems they see that is the trigger for them to think again. So they might see homophobia or sexism or something about the caste system or some other sort of exclusionary practice or threatening children with hell. And there's almost an ethical thing that makes them think, hold on, that doesn't feel morally right to me. But I think for people like you and me, where it was more of a background thing and the ethical stuff just felt like it'd be nice to each other, you know, there wasn't so much to object to there. So often it's a more epistemological thing where, you know, again, you think, you look at the evidence, you think about other religions, you know, consider the facts and you think, hold on, this just doesn't factually make sense. So there's like different paths,
right,
paths through.
Something I just can't get over too is how there are literally tens of thousands of religions, hundreds of thousands of religions. I don't understand how any one person can have so much faith, for lack of a better term, that their religion happens to be the correct one.
Yeah.
and there's a simple answer to that. It's just, oh, that's just religion that you were surrounded with from a young age. And so that tells me this isn't really rooted in real facts. It's rooted in how we grow up.
Yeah. And that was one of the things for me really was reading about lots of different religions. And when I put those in a more historical context, one, you look at all the different religions and you can see the commonalities and the differences and think, well, they can't all be true. But you can see that there's almost some common moral threads that run through them all, because those moral threads are actually common sense that predate any of the religions. So you look at the golden rule, that there's some element of that in most of the different religions, but it's there because it predated all of the religions, really. So you know, a lot of the good stuff that flows through the religions that they have in common, but then there are differences that are pretty radical, and their opinions of each other are also pretty tribal sometimes too. And that was partly that sort of comparative view that made me think, hold on, these really look like human inventions, right? It doesn't look like this. There's some solidly revealed truth. But I also like the way you softened that perspective too, because my degree of confidence that, how can I put this? The way I frame a naturalistic worldview, which is like one half of sentientism, is that we should use evidence to build beliefs. But those beliefs should always be provisional and probabilistic and prudent. They should never be pretending we've got all the facts and we have the perfect answers and we're 100% confident, because as soon as you're 100% confident, you're no longer open to any new evidence. So while on topics of, you know, religion and the supernatural, I might describe myself as an extreme agnostic, because I have such a little percentage confidence that these things could even be true that I'm not even interested in looking for the evidence anymore, because but it's still not zero. It's still not zero. There is still, you know, a conceptual possibility of that. And I think that's intellectually healthy as well. I think that's part of the problem of a scientific or an atheistic view, that it can come across as almost its own form of dogma. We have all the facts. We have all the answers. It cannot be challenged. And that's the antithesis of the naturalistic view.
Yeah, and I think that we need to, in general, live in a way that is less certain about things.
I think
there's a lot of people who are far too certain about their beliefs, whether it's religion or otherwise. And I think that really leads to the prevention of making progress as a society.
Yeah.
We need to accept that the world is not black and white. The world is very gray, different shades of gray. And so we really need to have more of an open mind, whether it's religion or politics or anything.
Yeah.
The idea of eating animals. Like, I think we need to have a substantially more open mind when it comes to everything. So
I agree. As soon as your doubt is gone and your confidence is complete, you stop improving, you stop learning, you stop getting less wrong, right? It's a dangerous dead end, I think, for, you know, naturalistic people as well as for people with supernatural worldviews. So I completely agree. And in a way, it's that propensity for doubt and that open-mindedness and that openness for new evidence that is the power of a naturalistic or a scientific worldview. That's how it faultingly and in a very sort of human, political, painful process, which has dead ends and makes mistakes, does over time self-correct, right? And without that doubt and without that open-mindedness, that whole process fails. And I think that part of the challenge for me is being open-minded but not being too quick to believe either. And I think that's part of the danger, is that some people will be, say, I refuse to believe this thing is even possible until there is really strong evidence presented. Others will say, yes, but these amazing, crazy, wonderful things could be possible. And often for an emotional reason, I now choose to believe in those things before the evidence is there. Whereas I quite like the approach of saying, I'm comfortable saying I don't know, and I'm comfortable saying I'm uncertain. Let's go and find out. But until the evidence is there, let's not build a belief in it. But let's keep looking and exploring.
Yeah, that's a really good point, how people are in different stages or areas of their ability to believe what they want to believe.
And
a lot of people just believe what they want to believe and are happy no longer questioning after that. So it's problematic for a number of reasons.
Yeah. The second question that I'm interested in discussing really flows from that, because some people like to keep their sort of epistemology, the facts and the evidence and the reason and what's real in the world, separate from their morality. And other people think they're intrinsically linked. And one of the reasons some people are nervous about moving away from a religious worldview is because they're worried they'll lose any foundations for their morals. If there isn't a supernatural being judging us and there aren't a list of commandments or rules to say what is wrong and what is right, do we lose our moral foundations? And I get the sense that you've never felt that. So if someone was to ask you what matters to you morally and why do those things matter morally, how would you answer that question? Is there a foundation to your morality, or how do you choose what's important?
So something that I read a piece of writing, an essay, when I went vegan. So in 2009, I read this piece. It's called Meaningful Life. It's written by Matt Ball. And he's the founder of Vegan, one of the founders of Vegan Outreach, which was the first animal protection organization I worked for. And I was really compelled by this piece of writing. And for any of your listeners, I would highly recommend just Googling it and reading it. And it's expanded upon much with a book called The Animal Activist Handbook. Anyway, essentially, and I'm probably paraphrasing and perhaps getting off the point of it, but what I took away from that is essentially all that matters in life is essentially two things. Almost everything comes down to two things. It is the pursuit of pleasure and joy and the avoidance of pain and suffering.
Yeah.
And if you take them equal parts against each other, the avoidance of pain and suffering is significantly more important. And that makes perfect sense to me. If you look at all of your actions, all of the actions of others, even outside of the human world, if you look at non-humans, almost everything comes down to one of those two aspects. And that really led me to choose to really advocate to reduce as much suffering as possible. Suffering is terrible. Obviously, there's different degrees of suffering. Mm. I certainly don't like feeling physical or emotional pain, but I'm thinking about if I accidentally burn my finger while I'm cooking, like that's awful. And something I actually end up finding myself doing nowadays is like when if I stub my toe or something, I think about the pain I'm in and I actually think, wow, animals experience this on a regular basis, farm animals especially, and it's totally legal and totally acceptable to the powers that be. And this is terrible. I want to do as much as I can to stop this.
Yeah.
And there'll always be pain and suffering in the world. As far as what we're doing to animals, especially farm animals on the sheer scale, is just tremendously awful. And so when I came to this determination that like all that matters is the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain, I want to focus on the avoidance of pain and suffering. And so all that matters is that.
Yeah.
Then you look at, okay, where are the areas of suffering in the world? And if you look at the sheer scale of animal farming, it is truly unbelievable. And perhaps some of your audience is already vegan, but I'm sure some aren't. And that's fine. It's why we're having this conversation. Mm. The sheer scale of farm animal suffering is so unbelievably large, both in quantity of sentient beings being living lives of absolute misery, but also the type of misery that they're forced to endure. Most egg-laying hens are kept in cages so small they can't even spread their wings. Mother pigs are forced to live in crates so small that they can't even turn around. So the suffering is just so awful. Mutilation without painkillers.
Yeah.
Because of the, you know, obviously it saves the these companies money. The confinement, the mutilation, the pain, the suffering that these animals endure is just so incredibly terrible. And it's for these reasons that I choose to focus on animal advocacy, particularly farm animal advocacy, and the way that I find to maximize the good that I can do within this moral framework of reducing suffering is by encouraging others to align their eating behaviors with these ethics that they already have. Yeah. Because you go around and you ask, everybody's already on the same page, right, Jamie?
Yeah.
Nobody says, you know what? I'm fine with animals suffering. They stub their toes too. And they say, wow, that sucks. I would not want my cat or my dog or some chicken that I'm eating or some pig that I'm going to eat one day to experience that. Everybody says, no, I don't want that. I view my job as an animal advocate to encourage these individuals, these human individuals, to make simple choices, changes in their day-to-day lives that are going to reduce this suffering. And fortunately, in 2021, it is easier than ever to live in a way that does align their behaviors with these ethics that they already have.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I think for you and me, that grounding for our ethics feels almost incontrovertibly common sense. I mean, how could you think of it in a different way? And in a way, that is the essence of sentientism, is that sentience is defined as the capacity to have experiences. You might describe suffering as all the bad stuff and flourishing as all the good stuff. And it's not just, as you said, it's not just the physical pains and pleasures, it's the full range of emotions as well. So yes, it's stubbing your toe, but it's also emotional angst and the feeling of familial loss. And on the upside, there's physical pleasures and satisfactions, but there's also love and a sense of connection and a sense of wonderment. You know, it's not a narrowly hedonistic range of experiences. It's all experiences, right? They all have value. And for me, that just is the root of all moral value. And I'll quite often ask people, I say, can you explain to me, can you describe to me any outcome, any result, any scenario that is morally good or morally bad without referring to the experiences of sentient beings? And I haven't yet found anyone convincingly who can do it. But the odd thing is that, you know, many people on the planet don't have that foundation for their ethics. So some will say, you know, they will acknowledge that suffering is generally bad and flourishing is, or pleasure is generally good. But actually, in a supernatural or a religious worldview, that's not the definition of good and bad. The definition of good and bad is the essence of the deity, which is, you know, perfect and good. And therefore, if the deity does something that causes harm or asks you to cause harm, that can actually be a morally good thing to do, even though it's completely needless. So that's partly why I do link these conversations to a sort of naturalistic, non-naturalistic view through to the ethics and the morality. But some people, even with a naturalistic worldview, will take another approach where they'll say, actually, our morality is something that is negotiated amongst different groups of humans. And there are different cultures and different traditions and different ways of imagining things and different ways of negotiating answers. And who are we to judge that this culture or that tradition or our own culture is doing things in the wrong way? And they almost come to, in the extreme, a relativistic position that says it's just up to a group of always humans that happen to have agreed what's right and what's wrong. And I can appreciate that often comes from a good place because it's people trying to understand the perspectives of others. But often it ends up excusing catastrophic harm, objective harm. So while I appreciate a sort of pluralistic approach, the grounding still comes back to the causing, needless causing of harm, or the needless, you know, or the causing of flourishing as a common sense. So I'm starting to rant now, but it feels to me like a naturalistic grounding. So you take your morals and your morality, and it's based on an understanding of what sentience is and which beings are likely to be sentient. And it feels like a much more solid moral foundation, a simpler foundation, more grounded in reality than any of the other alternatives. It's not, sadly, it's not common enough yet.
Yeah. And I mean, I think to like simplify things for everyone, most people have experiences with their pets, right? Like even in far-flung corners of the globe, a lot of people have pets, or if they don't have pets themselves, they know people who have pets. If they don't, then they have some sort of experience with animals. They won't want their pets to, you know, have pain, feel pain. They would never kick their dog. They would never step on their cat's tail purpose, do things that would cause these animals to suffer. And so it really is just simply applying what they would or wouldn't do to these animals and apply it to the animals that they're eating. And say, okay, if I wouldn't cut off part of my cat's ears without painkiller, maybe I shouldn't pay someone to do that to a pig.
Yeah.
If I wouldn't cut off my dog's tail without painkiller, then maybe I shouldn't do that, pay someone to do that to a cow. And it's simple. It's just basic consistency.
Yeah. But that's a difficult journey to go on. And it'd be interesting to know your story as well. And again, you've hinted at it already about going vegetarian and vegan, because I think even for people who see suffering as a negative thing, we still find clever ways to exclude certain beings from our moral consideration, at least practically. There are still many problems where people do that within the human race, where there are only certain types or groups of humans they give full moral consideration to. We know what that can lead to, and there's so much work still to do there. But one of the deep classic challenges is when you recognize that it's not just humans that suffer, and that it's not just human suffering that has moral salience either. And again, it's partly a balancing between the sort of clear, obvious, pretty stark facts of the matter about non-human animal suffering set against the societal indoctrination that teaches us, nearly all of us from birth, that it's completely acceptable and normal to pay other people to harm and kill for our pleasure. But so what was your journey through that? And was that a difficult thing to do societally and practically? How did you work through that struggle yourself?
Yeah, it was, for me, it was a conversation that I'd always considered myself an animal lover, even an animal. And then, you know, but I always ate animals 3 times a day. And it was a conversation that I had with someone where they basically said, if you consider yourself an animal lover, you should probably stop eating animals. And I had never made the connection until that point that, and I thought, wow, that actually makes a lot of sense. And so what that led me to do was to go vegetarian based on principle, on this principle or philosophy that I should not cause, or I should not eat animals if I'm an animal lover. I didn't know anything about how animals were being treated. I still thought that farm animals lived a pretty good life with one bad day.
You see the adverts with the frolicking cows and the happy lambs.
I still had this image in my head. And I actually did go vegetarian with the intent to go vegan. So in this, it was a 10-month process where I was like weaning myself off of animal products. I initially switched from, you know, went vegetarian, but then I switched from cow's milk to soy milk and almond milk. Switched from cow ice cream to cow dairy ice cream to coconut-based ice cream and so on. And again, this was just based on the philosophy that, hey, I should probably be consistent, but I didn't know anything about how animals were actually being treated. And then 10 months in, I watched a film called Earthlings. And Earthlings opened my eyes to the true treatment of farm animals and the fact that not only are they being killed they're not only just dying, they're being killed in incredibly large numbers. Each one of us impacts dozens of animals every year, including dairy cows and egg-laying hens, which I hadn't yet totally taken into consideration. Mm-hmm. And the scale of suffering that these animals are forced to endure is just mind-boggling. And so I thought, you know what, I absolutely need to go vegan now. I need to, you know, align my behaviors now with these ethics I already have and I've already had since birth. I had just never had it framed in me in a way that made so much sense. And so I was open-minded to the idea that the way I'd been living was not acceptable and that the way I should move forward was in a way that, you know, aligns these behaviors with the ethics I already have.
Yeah, thank you. And we'll come back to why the force of moral argument just doesn't seem to be enough when we talk about the future, but it's a common theme in these conversations. But there's one challenge to a sentientist way of thinking is that it's too broad and that only humans matter and that we need to focus on human concerns first. And you and I don't share that conviction, I think partly because by helping non-human animals will actually be good for humans too, given antimicrobial resistance and climate change and zoonotic disease. And so it's just an obvious win-win-win. But there's another challenge to sentientism, which says it doesn't go far enough. And says that it discriminates against entities that aren't sentient and can't suffer. So there are, you might call it biocentrism or ecocentrism, where people will say, actually, we need to have an even broader concern that includes plants and rivers and rocks and ecosystems and habitats as a whole. And while I'm sympathetic to that broadening of the moral circle or sphere, it seems that most of the people who want to push beyond sentience still carve out farmed animals and they carve out most wild sentient animals as well. So while they seem to have a generosity towards plants and rivers and rocks and mountains and ecosystems and species and habitats that can't suffer at all, they seem conveniently to carve out most of the non-human animals that can. So I'm interested in your view, both philosophically, about whether you do think we should grant a sort of intrinsic moral value to environments and so on as well, or whether it's just instrumental because of their relevance to sentient beings, but also your thoughts about the mainstream environmental movement and how that links to or doesn't link to animal ethics.
To me, like I said before, everything comes down to the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. And if a being cannot experience pain, then I don't see how that matters. Yes, if we should take rocks into consideration if that rock is going to impact in a being that can feel pain. I can't even think of an example of how that would play out. Obviously, okay, having a thriving forest is important for the animals, the sentient beings who live in that forest. So yes, in that case, I am supportive of keeping that forest healthy and thriving, but in the only because it's impacting these sentient beings.
Yeah.
Otherwise, why would that matter? Because we find it to be pretty? Like, that doesn't really matter. It certainly matters if it impacts sentient beings, but if not, I just don't see the case.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly my perspective. And it's interesting you mentioned it being pretty, because I think that cynically is a driving motivation for a lot of environmentalism. In a way, it's just another way of having an anthropocentric concern about humans reflected through a wider environmental concern. It's not really intrinsically concerned with the sentient beings that are suffering in those environments or in our farms.
Yeah. Exactly. And I do find that there is a big issue with the environmental movement where they seem to care more about the trees and the plants than the animals who call those home.
Yeah.
Or if they do care about those animals, then that's where their care stops. And I don't want to just say that they stop caring there, because I think they still do care about other animals. And if I were to hand them a knife, like, they wouldn't just stab a cow with it and say, you know, no, I want the cow to live a good, happy life and not die. But their behavior certainly stops there. And when you think about, like, why you would want to, you know, why do people care about the environment? If it's hopefully it's beyond just what that environment can provide for us. I don't think we're in the 1800s anymore, where we were just obsessed with just flattening everything possible so that we could thrive. I think that we care about the environment for the sentience within that. So I think that absolutely environmentalists should do more to take other beings suffering and ability to suffer into consideration. And if not, then that just is very concerning to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think we're struggling to disagree. The YouTube gods will hate this conversation because we're not destroying each other, John. What is going on?
Some comments rolling in.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear those.
But the final part of the conversation comes back to core focus of your own thinking, in that we've, in a way, the argument about animal ethics and animal farming in particular is almost over already, right? As you say, no one really has a moral justification for it. We'll hear all sorts of strange, bizarre gymnastics that people will sometimes use to try and justify these things retrospectively. But at its core, nearly everyone agrees with us that needlessly causing suffering to an obviously sentient being for transient human pleasure is hard to justify. So in that context, it seems difficult to understand why nearly 8 billion people on the planet, most of them still disagree with us, at least in practical terms of given the decisions they take. So in a way, I like to frame this question, you know, in an optimistic way and say, if we could magically persuade most of the 8 billion people on the planet to have that broader moral circle that includes all sentient beings and to take a more rational approach to their beliefs and their decisions about what's real, what could that future ultimately look like? And that might have a more optimistic cast. But then there's another challenging question, which is, okay, practically, given the depth of indoctrination and the sort of social inertia around the norms that hold otherwise really bright, careful, compassionate people into very harmful patterns, how the hell can we drive change faster? And obviously that's something you focus your life on. So what's your thoughts about what that future might look like, but also what are the best ways of pushing us towards it?
One of the issues that we face is that people don't want to believe that they're bad people.
Yeah.
Or doing a bad thing. I would say that, like, almost no one in the world says, I'm not a good person. Everybody wants to believe that they're a good person. And there, what does that include? That says, that means that the things that they're doing are not bad. And so when we confront people with the idea that what they've been doing for, you know, many years, for decades, eating animals, is causing harm and suffering, they don't want to believe it. They want to bury their head in the sand because suddenly realizing, wow, like, I'm causing all this harm and suffering. It's a hard thing to accept. And I understand.
Yeah.
And something that we need to do is, as effective animal advocates, is understand this and understand that when we talk to people, we need to understand and confront them with this knowledge. We need to understand that this is a big pill to swallow and that we can't necessarily expect them to go vegan overnight because of this new set of facts that we're presenting to them.
Yeah.
We have to chip away at the walls that people have built up, not just expect that we're going to demolish them overnight. So we need to be understanding that it's a big thing to accept that the way that they've been living for essentially their entire life is contradictory to the morals and ethics they already have. One area that's going to, and I've already been seeing this in recent years especially, that's going to make this easier is the fact that veganism and vegan eating is significantly easier now than it ever has been.
Yeah, practically and socially.
Yes, socially and practically. So 2021 is easier than 2020, significantly easier than 2015, way easier than 2009 when I went vegan. And certainly easier than it was back in the 90s when a lot of people I know went vegan. And so like we keep going back and further and obviously it's harder and harder, but today it's so much easier. And so when we couple this, this newfound knowledge to people and tell them, hey, just so you know, the chickens, pigs, cows, fish, and so on that you've been eating every year, they are suffering in awful ways and you are paying someone to do it. Obviously you frame it in a nice, kinder way, but when you present this knowledge and information to individuals, it's important to couple it with, okay, this is how you change. And hey, it is significantly easier now than it ever has been. I know in the UK, there's been lots of progress. Even in the US here, like you go to Burger King, you can purchase an Impossible Whopper. Taco Bell has vegetarian and vegan items marked on their menu. McDonald's is introducing the McPlant Burger.
Yeah.
Most grocery stores now carry the Beyond Burger, the Impossible Burger. And so the scale of which plant-based food is becoming accessible is making it easier for individuals to accept that the way that they've been eating is not aligned with the values that they have, but there's a way that they can change moving forward.
Yeah.
And given this, the easier way in this like inherent desire not to believe that they're a bad person, we need to make it as easy as possible. And so not only is like the introduction and spread of vegan plant-based food a very exciting endeavor, but the fact that clean meat is starting to become widely available. It's not widely available yet, but it's becoming introduced into society.
Yeah. And the price will come down fast. Yeah.
Yes. I think that will actually be what ultimately does it for animals. That is going to be the ultimate victory for animals, because just, you know, many technologies in the past that caused harm to animals, what ended up changing things wasn't necessarily a new moral acceptance of this new philosophy. It was really like, oh, this new technology came in and made our use of animals no longer necessary. And so I think that the fact that clean meat will become a thing in the coming years, I think will ultimately change everything. And I'm extremely excited about that. So I think that will actually end up doing far more good than every animal advocate making a moral case together. So the point I'm making here, Jamie, is that there's multiple reasons to be optimistic about the future. And I am generally optimistic about the future. And while, yes, you know, things were not good for a long time, and then things went from bad to almost as bad as humanly possible, starting in the 40s and 50s and 60s with the invention of factory farming and widespread adoption of it, I think that we're finally in a place where things are looking brighter for animals everywhere.
Yeah, thank you. And I like the way you frame that, because you're almost saying that most of humanity already has these sort of latent positive values about sentient beings and not wanting to cause needless suffering. How much point is there in really driving that point home over and over again? Because people already have those values, those ethical values by and large. But if we can make, you know, the switch socially more normal and practically easier and make the transition easier, maybe we can then tap into those latent values and make a change happen very fast.
Absolutely.
And one of the interesting topics that I hope at the moment not many people focus on, but I hope will become more of an issue, is actually thinking about how we can make that transition just for the people who are involved in those industries today as well, in the same way as arguably we failed to do in historic industries, where we've let, you know, many of the people employed in those businesses and in those supply chains just struggle through. When we're looking at things like fossil fuel industries, and certainly with industrial animal agriculture, we need to think about how we can divert subsidies and solutions to help the people whose lives are intricately bound up in those industries, you know, how we can help them transition to something that's more ethical and more environmentally sustainable as well. So I think there's a lot of research and a lot of work to do in that just transition. And you can already see some fascinating pilots of things like the Rancher Advocacy Program, working with individual farmers, helping them think about new business models and shift and switch. So you know, we just need to see tens or hundreds of thousands of those, not just 10. So
yeah. Lots of exciting things happening in the animal advocacy world.
Yeah, absolutely. John, it's been an absolute inspiration to talk to you. It's great to end on an optimistic note, particularly seeing as we've spent so much time talking about a deeply difficult subject. But the answers are obvious ethically and practically. So we just need to get on with it. So it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Yeah, thank you. So what's the best way of people keeping up with all your amazing social media work?
Yeah, people can follow me on social media, which are the tools that I use to advocate for animals. On Twitter and Instagram, my handle is at John Oberg, J-O-H-N-O-B-E-R-G. On Facebook, it's John Oberg Official. Feel free to follow me on those platforms. If anybody wants to visit my website or learn how they can do social media consulting with me, they can go to johnoberg.org.
That's great. Thank you. And I'll, of course, include all of those links in the show notes. So.
Thanks so much, Jamie. This has been real fun, real pleasure. I don't usually dive so deep into philosophy, so this has been fun and new for me. So I appreciate you challenging me to get to this level and chatting with me about it. This has been fun.
It's a real pleasure. And hopefully it's a little distinctive from a lot of the other conversations out there, because it is that going to the deep but simple philosophy and digging a little bit under the surface. So it's been a privilege to have these conversations. So thank you.
Yes, this has been fun. Thanks, Jamie.
All right. Take care.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?